Hey everyone, welcome back to the Commercial Real Estate Library Podcast. I'm Dama Tamanawala, you know my co-host Garrett McGilvery, and joining us today is the president and CEO of Choice Properties, Choice Real Estate Investment Trust, Rael Diamond. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I'd love for you to give us the 10,000 foot view on just what is Choice and what's your role at the company, obviously leading the charge.
So Choice Properties is a real estate investment trust. As you said, we are actually the largest REIT in Canada. We own 700 properties. We have roughly $16 billion of assets. From an income perspective, about 80% of our income is grocery anchored retail. Loblaw would be our largest tenant. We do have other grocery tenants as well, but Loblaw is our largest tenant because we are controlled by George Weston, which is also the parent company of Loblaw. About 15% of our income comes from industrial properties, and about 5% of our income comes from mixed-use residential properties. We pride ourselves in the strength of our balance sheet, and we just think it's a compelling investment opportunity with, you know, very, very stable assets, growth coming out of our future developments, which we can speak about later, and then this very, very strong balance sheet. So as you mentioned, I'm very fortunate to be the CEO of Choice Properties, and I work with a phenomenal team of real estate professionals.
Okay, so here's what we want to cover during this. We want to, as you mentioned, we want to get into the whole company objectives, where you guys are going to be in 5 years, what are the current challenges, exciting opportunities, all that stuff. We want to get into the market, of course, but why don't we start with your background, how you got involved in, even in real estate, we can pick up on an accent from South Africa. Yeah. What's the backstory?
All right. So as you said, I'm South African. I moved to Canada when I was just under 19 years old. And my parents wanted to leave South Africa, and my older brother and myself came a year earlier than myself. And my parents were going to follow shortly thereafter. I studied accounting, and why accounting is every good business South African that I ever met was an accountant. So I always had this idea that I have to be an accountant, and studied accounting. I did an undergrad at York University, and I actually worked in this building on this floor. The 14th floor at Brookfield Place was my first job, which was Deloitte & Touche. Wow. And in fact, when I emailed to find out where I was going and you were the 14th floor at Brookfield Place, I had flashbacks to my earlier days. So I'm an accountant. My first job at Deloitte, they assigned me to a funeral home company. And why I was on a funeral home is because I was in the financial institution group, and the financials in funeral homes, you know, hold large, you know, cash positions, given people prepay their lots. And I went to my boss at the time and I said, oh, I really don't want to be on a funeral home. And he said to me, well, the worst job in the office is a real estate entity. I won't say the name. The worst job in the office is a real estate entity. People work long, long hours. How do you feel about switching into real estate? And I said, great. And honestly, it was by far the best random lucky move ever. And that is how I got into real estate. And I've truly loved it ever since. I learned it from the accounting side. And then when I was at Deloitte, you know, tapped me on my shoulder and said, why don't you go and meet our client, was back then was Brascan. You know, Brookfield or Brascan at that time used to hire, you know, accountants, was pre Sarbanes-Oxley. And I was the fortunate position to get a job at Brookfield in their real estate group, actually as their controller. From Brookfield, phenomenal training ground.
What is a controller, by the way? I picture it like a CFO, basically, but
in the CFO's world, you know, he or she would be responsible for various functions, investor relations, you know, accounting, IT are the three general ones. So the accounting function, so controlling the books and records, was essentially a controller responsible for the accounting function of a public entity. I actually started as the controller of the Canadian commercial division. So essentially the Canadian office company.
Wow.
you know, I'd moved around a bit with Brookfield. I'd lived in New York for 4 years, and it was time to come back to Canada. I joined an entity as Crete. I was the CFO of Crete for a few years. I then moved to the chief operating officer of Crete, and Choice purchased Crete in 2018. And I took over the current role in 2019. And I truly believe that Choice is the best positioned REITs in the industry, and we can definitely speak about that later.
You might be biased.
I am biased. I'm sure everyone who says biased, but yes, I am biased.
Can you talk about the acquisition of Crete, also known as C-REIT for others folks? Can you talk about what that acquisition was to Choice, and like what was happening internally at the time, and you know what changed in the transition that you kind of led?
So Choice, so going back in 2013, Loblaw, so Galen West and Richard Dufresne had the view that they could maximize the value of their real estate and shine a light on it. And they spun out a small interest in their real estate entity, which was Choice Properties. And for the first 5 years of existence, you know, Choice was obviously very focused on grocery anchored real estate, but really trying to intensify that real estate with pad development. But they always knew for the entity to be a real standalone real estate entity, you know, it had to diversify more away from Loblaw. And the only way that it could do that was by buying, you know, another real estate entity. Crete actually was the first REIT in Canada. Mm. It was founded by an individual, Stephen Johnson, who actually was the CEO of Choice post the acquisition. Crete was a diversified portfolio, had very low leverage. It was focused on grocery anchored retail or retail, industrial, and then some office assets. And Choice saw Crete as a great target to, you know, help diversify away from Loblaw, not because Loblaw is not phenomenal real estate, it is, but more it solidified it as a true real estate entity. The transition was hard, and I never led it. I was part of the team that was involved in the integration. The transition was hard. We made definitely some mistakes on the integration, primarily, I would say, some communication mistakes. We should have communicated more with colleagues on, you know, how they fit into the larger organization. So, you know, the systems integration was hard, but honestly, our culture today is truly phenomenal. We actually do culture surveys. And the first time we did a culture survey was in 2019, and our engagement scores were like, you know, call it 50%. So 50% of our employees said this was a great place to work. And today, the majority of our colleagues say that Choice is a great place to work. So something that we're very proud of. Probably the thing I'm most proud of is just how our culture has changed over the last 5 years.
I love those surveys, because our managers come around and they're like, we can't force you to do it, but we would like you to. Yeah.
We have the exact same challenges. Yeah. We can't force anyone to do it, but we strongly encourage it.
Yeah. It's helpful. It's helpful too to get that feedback. So, okay. So acquired is February 2018 when the acquisition happened.
Valentine's Day.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah, there you go. That's my dog's birthday. Fun fact. so like, were you guys, so COVID was what, March 2019?
Like March 2020.
2020. Okay. Yeah. Okay. When all of my deals died, that was the time. It was a heartbreaking time. Can you talk about, like, so you guys were fully together at that time. Like, what sort of challenges did you go through then? Because you're the best positioned as kind of, you know, grocery anchored retail was like
the safest asset class at the time.
Yeah. Look, We during COVID, you're right, performed the best. And we performed the best because we honestly had the right assets, and primarily grocery anchored retail. You know, the large majority of our retail tenants, which are the grocery store pharmacies or true necessity based tenants, were open. So we actually had the highest rent collection. But, you know, the challenges were the same as many others, in that we had to learn how did we, you know, work from home when our systems truly didn't allow for it? Like in the beginning, we were doing conference calls, we were doing Skype.
Right.
You know, for me, for me, you know, I wouldn't say the scariest moment, but it was a crazy moment where we took certain things so for granted. For example, rent collection. You know, like the rent used to come in and no one ever on the fifth day of the month or the third day of the month said, how many tenants paid us? It was so for granted that over the month, we'd look at our monthly financial statements at the end of the month. And by then, most tenants had paid us. But if you think about COVID, everyone's working from home. Some yeah. tenants are mailing in checks. Some tenants were withholding rents.
Right.
And mm-hmm. we honestly had no idea who had paid our rent.
Right.
And it was, so to me, it was, you know, what COVID did, it forced us to be a lot better on, you know, how do we collect revenue and what systems are in place to collect revenue. And it's something that every real estate entity took for granted. But I think like Choice, every real estate entity had to pivot and say, oh God, how do I get this cash in the door? And you know, the other challenging thing was, you know, so difficult, you know, you wanted to try and retain as many tenants as you could. Mm. And governments were obviously responding accordingly with programs to support tenants. And it was just a confusing time. But as I say, by then, we had really solidified our culture. You know, our colleagues were working well together and it was phenomenal. People worked so hard and really, you know, communicated and rallied behind and Teams calls. And, you know, we take Zoom and Teams so for granted today, but we didn't have it on as part of our systems in the early days of COVID.
Yeah. Yeah. That was a huge evolution. And now, flash forward, everybody has like standing Teams calls and all these things that are every week.
Every week.
It's really interesting because during that time period, even with you guys have the highest quality tenants of anyone, but yeah, I remember selling at Tim Hortons and it's like the tenant wasn't paying.
Yeah.
Tim Hortons, like what's going on?
Yeah.
So everybody, there are question marks for everything basically.
We sold an asset in the US. We actually had one asset in the US, a really good power center in the suburbs of Chicago. And I believe the purchaser collected zero rent the first month of ownership. It closed literally like, call it 2 weeks before the world shut down. Can you imagine buying a, you know, $80 million asset and you get no rent the first month of ownership?
Yeah, that'd be brutal.
Yeah, that'd be scary. I'm sure the lenders would be all over you at that point. And you know, I mentioned I work in multifamily and sometimes the government would come out and say, well, hey, hold on, you don't need to pay. And it's like, wait, what? This is a little confusing, but okay. So that was back in 2019 and some of the challenges then. Can you talk about the flash forward over the last four years, the evolution that you guys have gone through and kind of what the priorities have been?
If you think of Choice has, you know, grown from call it, you know, the fourth or fifth largest REIT to the largest REIT. And that was through a combination of the acquisition of CREIT that you mentioned. But also since then, we've done about $4 billion of transactions, you know, buying and selling assets. And initially, a lot of our dispositions were focused on improving the quality of our balance sheet. So we as a management team felt it was important, and obviously with alignment with George Weston and the board, was felt important to have a strong balance sheet. So we sold assets to help us delever, obviously, our balance sheet. And then we sold assets to improve the quality of our portfolio, and we focused on specific asset classes. So today we focused on retail, we focused on industrial, and we focused on multifamily or purpose-built rental. We had a large office portfolio, which we didn't feel it had the same ability to get the same scale that our retail or industrial or over time our residential could. So we actually did a unique transaction with Allied where we sold them, you know, six very high quality assets in exchange for units. And then the remaining office assets we actually sold over time. So I'd say that, so it's the deleveraging and then the disposition of office and then leaning more into industrial and purpose-built rental were, you know, the major changes that have happened over the last 5 years since the acquisition of CREIT. But as I say, it's been a collective effort and we are in phenomenal shape today.
And when you
are investing in the industrial asset class, is that something that is being occupied by the Westons or Loblaws and stuff like that? Or is that properties that you are leasing out to third parties?
About 60%, just under 60% of our retail income comes from Loblaw. On the industrial side, it's about 30% comes from Loblaw. And we view Loblaw as a huge competitive advantage. And the reason I say that is, you know, firstly, when it comes to the neighborhood shopping centers, you know, we obviously have a right to buy future sites from Loblaw. When we're buying sites on the market, we can figure out a win-win for both Choice and Loblaw. For example, buying a Shoppers Drug Mart on Eglinton Avenue where Loblaw may have been out of term, where we could restructure the lease and Choice has great holding income and a future development site. But on the industrial side, as an example, we've tied up land I'll give you an example. We tied up land during COVID, actually, for Loblaw's supply chain, modernization or investment. We tied up some land in East Gwillimbury, and we tied it up through a mezz loan structure through an existing partner we have, which is Rice Commercial Developments. And it's that competitive advantage, knowing that you potentially have a tenant. So it was 150 acres. Loblaw, essentially, within a few months of tying up the land, we leased the land to Loblaw, 100 acres of the 150 acres. That's a huge competitive advantage if you know you have that tenant. So to answer your question, we do most of our industrial assets actually are leased to third parties. But wherever we can help Loblaw with their growth plans, if it's on the retail or the industrial, we would do so because we truly believe it's a win-win for both Choice and for Loblaw.
Number one, does it create any sort of with Loblaw being the biggest tenant, are they always leasing at market, or do you try and help them out based on the ownership of the building? You know what I mean?
So when we're buying from them, everything is done at market.
Got it, okay.
We always use appraisals, and we get, brokers involved to assist us, but it's all done at market, and it's a truly, I view it as a real win-win, relationship where we try to help them with their growth plans. We get great long-term, real estate investments, which are very stable, but everything is done at market.
Gotcha. Do you have to be careful of, I won't mention the retailer, but I remember hearing of this guy who was like the acquisitions guy for this big retail giant, and they would go in, sign a 20, he would tie up the building personally, and then they would go in, sign a 20-year lease or something, and he would flip it like the next day. Like, do you have to be really careful about, the people in those acquisitions roles? When you talk about the Rice, you immediately added a tremendous amount of value. So I'm just thinking about what that creates.
So that behavior at our organization would not be tolerated. I've heard that it happened historically at other organizations, but it would not be tolerated at our organization. So we have a small investments team which has done a lot of transactions. I actually sit right by the investments team. They're probably 5 individuals in the investments team, but none of them would ever behave like that. I can assure you that.
Okay. All right.
I guess on the other 40% of the 60% on your retail, is there any other larger occupants aside from Shoppers and Loblaws?
If you think of a typical neighborhood shopping center,
yeah,
that is what we own. So who are the large tenants? Like Canadian Tire is a large tenant. LCBO is a large tenant. The banks are large tenants. Those would be our larger tenants. But, when we think of our necessity-based retail, we think of the groups that were truly open during COVID. So if it's, pharmacy, if it's obviously supermarkets, pharmacy, banks, liquor, pet stores, doctor and dentist's office. When we look at that footage, we have more square footage of that tenant type than any other Canadian REIT's entire retail portfolio. So it just speaks to the strength of our true necessity-based retail. It's, the tenants that were open during COVID, and that's, those are the tenants that typically occupy our retail plazas.
Again, as Loblaws can also be a major competitive advantage, do you ever, again, you guys are expanding your portfolio and you're sort of de-risking yourself from this particular note, but do you guys consider like concentration risk because you are pretty married to Loblaws? Like if Loblaws were to have any problem, I know they're on the up and up and they're, you know, crushing profits, everything like that, but you know, you are tied to a singular company and therefore, you know, the concentration risk is there in some sense.
Yeah. And that is one of the pushbacks we get from investors. It's, you know, Loblaw in our minds is, you know, the strongest grocery retailer in Canada. And it is a risk that some investors highlight, but we actually view the advantages of having the tenant
for sure
as far more beneficial than, you know, the risk you identified.
Yeah, for sure.
In fact, we're sitting here and we're now, you can see there is a Loblaw on Queen's Quay just behind these buildings. Like Choice owns that.
Looks like a great development site.
It's a phenomenal development site one day. But you know, and that's reality. If the tenant ever decides to give up the location, many of our properties have real redevelopment potential. They have redevelopment potential regardless of the tenant closing, just given the land sizes we own. But if you just think of Toronto, Choice has more dots on the map in Toronto than any other REIT, probably than any other, you know, entity. And those dots on a map will be something different in the future. And that is part of our future redevelopment potential.
Yeah.
Steve, who was in here earlier, asked a good question. He said, I will ask him about the income versus intensification value. Because he said, you know, looking at First Capital and RioCan and all these other big REITs, they'll always come out and say, look, these are all development sites. And they invest heavily in that. But then sometimes the market still values you guys from just an income approach. Like, how do you think about that for
a
Choice?
And look, if you were selling a property and a tenant was there and the tenant had 50 years of lease term on it, there is no real redevelopment potential today. There's only redevelopment potential if you can move the tenant, work with the tenant, close the tenant. But unless you can do that, there is no real redevelopment potential. And I think, again, that speaks to, so on that type of property, it should be valued more like an income property.
Right.
And maybe on, you know, the lower cap rate side, because there is that real future upside. But at the end of the day, it should be an income property. But one of our advantages is, again, we're trying to work with Loblaw. And in fact, in the creation of Choice, you know, Loblaw did something really smart. They created something called the Strategic Alliance Agreement. So what's the Strategic Alliance Agreement? It governs our relationship between Choice and Loblaw. I.e., if we have supermarket space, we have to offer it to Loblaw first. If Loblaw's selling an asset, they have to offer it to us first. But if we're intensifying properties, we have to pay them a small fee. And the fee ranges based on what you're building in the market. But the most expensive fee payments we ever pay them is if you build condo in, call it Toronto. And the numbers, you know, it's all publicly disclosed, but call it the numbers $30 a foot. But think of the cost of buying a piece of land in today's interest rate environments, holding that piece of land for 5 years. I can promise you now the interest expense or the carry cost will be a lot higher than $30 a foot. So the phenomenal thing is it incentivizes us to develop the property, because we don't have carry on the land. We have income coming from Loblaw, and it incentivizes Loblaw to work with us because they're getting this payment and it's pre-negotiated. And that again speaks, you know, to one of the benefits that we have that, you know, RioCan or First Capital wouldn't have, given our major tenant. We've pre-negotiated, you know, the deal on the redevelopment.
Do you, okay, so rates are high.
How are they?
Everybody's feeling it. So how, being a public market operator, how has it affected you over the last year or so? Just this crazy interest rate hiking environment.
Right. So I spoke earlier about the first thing we did was we sold assets to delever our balance sheet. Right. So again, I truly believe we are best positioned because we have the lowest leverage. In fact, you know, when we issue debt publicly, we issue it at the lowest credit spreads of any of the Canadian REITs. We have the highest, one of the highest, or if not the highest credit rating of any of the Canadian REITs. But we've actually been impacted probably more than most. And you may say, well, how, if you have the lowest leverage, have you been impacted more than most? And it's because of the way we manage the balance sheet. The way we have managed the balance sheet is that we have a 10-year ladder. And what that means, we have 10% of our debt coming due every single year. Hmm. Whereas other REITs, they have shorter debt terms than us, but it's lumpier. And we've done more refinancings than other REITs have done. In fact, probably a year ago, we did a debenture issue where we issued debt at 6%. And we got a lot of heat from investors, and I'd say also other REITs, on issuing this debt at 6%. And it was done, I call it a 250 basis point spread. But for us, you know, the way we think about it, we're always going to try and do long-term debt, and we're going to keep our ladder. We're going to stick to our strategy. And the reality today, you know, other REITs couldn't even issue at 6% where the 10-year bond is at 3.8%. So you never know what tomorrow is going to bring. And for us, you know, we've continuously stuck to our strategy of keeping this 10-year ladder, you know, and we'll continue to push out debt term wherever we can.
Interesting. Whereas other, I'm just picturing the guys with the lumpier debt terms, yeah. And then they're fine right now, and then next year they go, holy Jesus.
And if interest rates go down, they're going to be right. And if they stay elevated, it's going to be very painful. But for us, it's you know, the CFO, he always says to me, he says, you know, his real focus is make sure that the balance sheet never gets in the way of running the business. And in COVID, we actually got some phenomenal opportunities in COVID because we had a strong balance sheet and we could actually use it. So I spoke about that East Gwillimbury mm-hmm. opportunity. We bought a portfolio of industrial assets on long-term leases, you know, which at that time was, you know, healthy pricing, but, you know, given where industrial land has gone, it was very cheap. We also bought, you know, almost 400 acres in Caledon, and was a very large purchase. But it was those large acquisitions that we could do given we had that strong balance sheet.
It's really interesting. So, like, a lot of our conversation is focused on this environment that we're in. That's why we wanted to kind of go back, because at least from an investment standpoint, a lot of our audience, they're brokers and they're going, mm-hmm. what the hell is going on? This is crazy. But let's talk about the flip side of it. Looking out, you know, 2-3 years, what opportunities are you most excited about?
Yeah, look, let's speak quickly just on the environment. So this environment favors those, and I believe this environment favors those with a strong balance sheet and favors those with the right assets. If you have the right assets, mm-hmm. you can, you know, you will be able to source debt. Honestly, if I had a crystal ball and could tell you what's going to happen 2 or 3 years from now, you should all buy Choice stock because we are going to do phenomenally well. But we don't have that crystal ball. So we're going to focus running our business, which enables us to take advantage of opportunities if things get dislocated. And, you know, it's interesting, you know, there's a research group in the US called Green Street, and they did a report. It was actually just after the financial crisis, saying, you know, it's been proven that entities with lower leverage outperform over time. And you may say, well, that makes no sense because, you know, if interest rates have been so low, you know, entities with higher leverage should actually outperform. Mm. And the reason they say it is because it's been proven that in times of stress or in times of distress or, you know, entities with weak balance sheets focus on fixing their balance sheets. They miss opportunities. They have to go do dilutive equity raises. And, you know, there've definitely been others in the US and in Canada who have to sell their best assets because those are the ones you can sell at the moment. And you just think about it, you're selling your best assets. It's very short-sighted in light of a very long-term asset class. So that's why we very much focus on maintaining the strong balance sheet. And if you have a strong balance sheet, you know, we will procure or source debt. And if you have the right assets, you'll get the debt. It's when those two things, you own the wrong assets and wrong capital structures, when you land up in trouble.
Yeah. And you can be in position to buy those best assets
and we'll see. And so I don't know what tomorrow is going to bring, but that's why we maintain on having that strong balance sheet so we can take advantage of those opportunities if they come. And if they don't come, it's fine too, because we can continue to do, you know, development and invest in our business without relying on the capital markets.
Are you guys going to stay in Canada? Like your portfolio is exclusively in Canada now, right? So with that in mind, and within this position that you guys are in, what sort of big opportunities might be presenting themselves? Like, are you looking at some of these C-REIT or CREIT-sized opportunities right now and saying we could buy that for pennies?
Look, so firstly, on your first part of the question, we are going to stay in Canada. Yeah. And why we're going to stay in Canada is just, you know, that we have a real platform in Canada and we have phenomenal opportunities, primarily through development. And we have more uses of our capital than capital available to us. We have no platform to go and compete in the US. So that is why for now we are definitely staying in Canada. Look, we're always looking for opportunities, and the opportunities have to make us better or improve our cash flow, or give us something different that we don't have. And we will, you know, we'll always monitor it. We work closely with George Weston on monitoring it, but there's nothing in the immediate term that I foresee.
What is he like? What the Weston family? Do they obviously you interact with them? Is there something like ultra uncommon that? Like a way that they're so different than anybody else that's allowed them to become so successful?
Look, I can't speak to the family. I only deal occasionally with Galen Weston. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I must say that I have learned a lot from him. Mm. He, you know, he's always given me the time that I've needed from him. When you sit with him in a meeting, he's 100% focused and attentive to what you're saying. He adds value, he gives suggestions, and it's truly been inspiring to work with him.
Wow, okay. I'm always, and again, it's an interesting question to ask a guy like you, because you're at the top. You're already, you know, the head of the biggest REIT in Canada. So I appreciate you answering that question, but another tough one. What is something that you believe that very few other people believe to be true?
No, and look, I'm not saying it's few others, but it's something that I truly believe to be true that may be an unpopular answer at the moment. I believe in engagement in an office environment. And you know, I think back to my career, and we can speak about why in a moment, but, you know, I've worked with phenomenal people and I've learned from phenomenal people and I've developed relationships with phenomenal people. And I don't believe that that can be done over Zoom. And, so I know it's an unpopular answer, but I think share their views singularly. Like many people would believe that to be true. I know it's just an unpopular thing to say at the moment.
Yeah. By the way, I couldn't agree more. I think everybody who doesn't come in should be fired, but that's just me. Connor is the head of what were you saying before?
REITs at Bishops.
Okay. Yeah. The head of REITs at Bishops. Do you have any questions for Rael?
I have a couple. I kind of want to bring a full circle where you talk about the culture at Choice, and I've talked with people at Choice and they rave about it. How did you kind of foster that culture at Choice, and what did you do in particular?
Yeah, look, firstly, we took culture principles from George Weston, and you know, the culture principles from George Weston and Loblaw were really surrounded by something that they call blue culture. And but at the end of the day, when you step back, like blue culture is about treating people how you want to be treated and about being engaged and trying to advance, you know, the business in a forward momentum way. And so that's the principles we adopted. But I would say at Choice in particular, you know, everyone sits in the open, including myself. We really you know, try and treat people how we would want to be treated. And I think it's a very friendly environment. You know, we're a small organization. We only have called roughly 300 people. And you know most people. And you know, because we're not in offices and because we are in the in the open, you can get to develop, you know, personal relationships with people and get to know the person while you're working on a project with them.
It's crazy, and that's a great answer, but it's crazy in real estate how you guys are a $16 billion company and you only have 300 people. That's wild.
Yeah. Look, and part of the reason is look, so we have some properties where we have one or two tenants on those properties, and one person can manage multiple properties.
Yeah.
And, you know, some of those properties are exceptionally valuable, you know, with a single tenant paying you rent. So we are lucky. But generally, real estate, you find that where the assets are disproportionately large for the number of people that you have.
Mm-hmm.
I'd say when we did sell our office assets, like office were more people, you know, intensive, just, you know, the number of building operators or property managers you would have at a property.
Let me just ask this one market news question. So I think Connor was telling me Allied just sold $1.35 billion.
Mm-hmm. Data centers.
Yeah, maybe some non-core. They have that. They're very involved in the internet, I'm learning.
Yeah.
Michael, I think, is going to be on the podcast in a week or two. But what do you think about that transaction and what that means for those guys?
Look, Michael had done a phenomenal job maximizing value of that asset. And Connor may know how much he bought it for and what he sold it for. But, you know, the important thing for Allied, from our perspective, we are not an insider of Allied. We don't sit on the board. We do own 8.5% of them. Through that transaction, I said. But the important thing from my perspective is that, you know, they got $1.35 billion in the door, which allows them to strengthen their balance sheet and allows them to operate their entity through this period of, you know, call it uncertainty, re-office, even though I truly believe in office and I truly believe in their portfolio, but it allows them to operate their entity without relying so much on the capital markets. It comes back to the earlier thing I said, that in this environment, people with the right assets or people with the right balance sheets will do fine. And this put Michael and Allied in a position that they have the right balance sheet in this environment. So I think it was a phenomenal transaction for them.
Yeah. So my question is not real estate related. If you were to give one piece of advice to, say, a new entrant into the commercial real estate space, somebody that's might be coming out of university, trying to, you know, break their way into this space, like Connor, what piece of advice would you give to that person?
Go to the office.
Go to the office.
It's funny you say that, but I don't think this advice relates just to real estate. I think it relates to showing up every day. And what I mean by showing up, it's, you know, the story I was going to tell you about why I am a firm believer in you know, working in an office environment, it was actually happened on this floor. You know, we're in accountants, and accountants have hoteling and bullpens. And honestly, my friends who worked with me, a lot of them wanted to hide if we could sit, I can sit on the 16th floor and then no one will find me and therefore I don't get work. And, you know, I always sat on the 14th floor, and I was fortunate that I one day randomly sat outside this partner's office. His name was Seymour Temkin. His name is Seymour Temkin. And he grabbed me and he started putting me on an assignment, and I did his financial modeling. And I learned so much being dragged around by him to do financial modeling. And it was that taught me that you have to be present and show up. And today I find, you know, so many people want to be at home and on Zoom. And I'm not saying there's not a time and a place for it, but if you want to advance and you want to learn from people around you, you know, you're never going to get that great assignment, whatever industry you're in. Like, no one's going to, I'm going to Zoom Connor and give him this piece of work. They're going to walk up to someone who's sitting in front of them that they can see and say, hey, Connor, if you're sitting there, I have this great piece of work, and here it is. And I just think it's natural human, you know, behavior. And I think that is the single biggest, you know, piece of advice I would give someone. And then I'd say the second thing is, honestly, I work for phenomenal people. And, you know, it doesn't really matter what you do, but work for someone that truly wants you to be successful and wants you to grow. And, you know, if they want you to be successful and they want to invest in you, you'll do well. So it's showing up and then surrounding yourself with the right people is the key thing.
Well said.
That's awesome. And I think that's a great thing about your mentors and the people that you're working with. Cause not everybody wants you to, some people want you to stay where you are and stay in that role.
But then you shouldn't work for those people.
Shouldn't work for them. And it's
funny. Unless they want you to stay in that role because they truly believe that you need more time in that role to succeed.
Yeah.
But then they should be open with you about that.
Yeah. Right. And I love that you mentioned you worked in this office because I think it's faint, but you can still see under a couple lines of paint that says Rail in the washroom. Rail was here. My final, I'm always interested if you couldn't buy Choice stock, and you have an extra $3 million lying around, but you have to invest it somewhere in the real estate asset class, any asset class somewhere in Canada, where would you put that?
Personally.
And again, it's not trying to speak up our own own book, but what I do love about grocery anchored retail is, you know, you have great holding cash flow, you own a piece of land, the cities continue to densify, and over time that will be something different. And even if it's a suburban location, over time as the population grows around it, like that piece of real estate's irreplaceable. So for me, that is just a great long-term investment where you buy something where you have great long-term cash flow and then you have potential upside. So I would look for an asset that gives me good long-term cash flow and potential upside. And truthfully, it could be in apartments too. If you find something that is under-rented in apartments and you believe that there is that, you know, stable long-term cash flow, and as tenants turn, given what's going on, you know, with population growth, you'll get income growth. And that to me is a wonderful long-term investment. But awesome. You have to be patient.
You have
to be patient.
Yeah. And you have to survive those downturns and have a stable balance sheet.
Yes. Exactly.
Right. Okay. Well, that's what I have.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
No, it was that was great. Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you, Rao.
Appreciate you coming.